Freemasonry appears to have many faces. The Christians call them Satanists, while philosophers like Manly P. Hall call them the Order of the Quest. In Manly P. Hall's The Secret Destiny of America, he states that colonization of the Western Hemisphere was largely motivated in the desire to pillage the fabulous treasures of the New World. The explorers, led on by legends of hoards of gold and silver and palaces encrusted with jewels, formed expeditions, often financed from their own purses, but sometimes subsidized by the state. The Spanish were the most successful in their quest for riches. The majority of other adventurers profited little and suffered much. And it soon became apparent that only by sober colonization was any sizable reward to be gained in the New World. For the promulgation of the Christian faith, the Western Hemisphere offered virgin territory. With the conquistadors came priests, eager to convert pagan tribes and nations to the faith of the Old World. A holy inquisition was set up in New Spain, and Indians by the tens of thousands were tortured and killed for the good of their immortal souls. It was due to the zeal of the priests that the libraries of the Mayans were burned and their historical records destroyed. To this day there stands in Merida, on the peninsula of Yucatan, the house of the conquistador Montejo. Over the door of this house there are heraldic arms of this Spanish adventurer. The shield and crest are upheld by Spanish soldiers standing on the heads of tortured and enslaved Mayan Indians. Reasonably accurate accounts of the natural advantages and resources of the Americas were in time brought back by the explorers and adventurers who had opened the new territories of the West, and only then did the European nations give serious consideration to actual development of their newly acquired colony empires. The French, the Dutch, and the English entered upon programs of establishing permanent settlements along the Atlantic seaboard. The English program was under the direction of Sir Francis Bacon, and it was his genius that gave purpose to the enterprise. Bacon quickly realized that here in the New World was the proper environment for the accomplishment of his great dream, the establishment of the philosophic empire. It must be remembered that Bacon did not play a lone hand. He was the head of a secret society, including in its membership the most brilliant intellectuals of his day. All these men were bound together by a common oath to labor in the cause of a world democracy. Bacon's Society of the Unknown Philosophers included men of high rank and broad influence. Together with Bacon, they devised the colonization scheme. Word was passed about through secret channels that here in the Western Hemisphere was the promised land of the future. Here, men of right purpose could build a new way of life, free from the religious intolerance and political despotism that held Europe in its clutches. The history books tell us that the colonists made the long and dangerous journey in small ships in order to find a place where they could worship God, each according to the dictates of his own conscience. There is, however, much more to the story than our historians have dared to suggest. Among the colonizers were some who belonged to the Order of the Quest. But it was not long before religious strife broke out in the colonies, for men do not change their natures merely by changing their place of habitation. Much of the intolerance of the Old World came over to plague the beginnings of the new civilization. It was not easy to preserve high principles in pioneering a country. A lot had to be done before the philosophic empire could emerge out of the simple struggle for existence, and much has yet to be accomplished. We are still pioneering in the sphere of right thinking and right living. Bacon's secret society was set up in America before the middle of the 17th century. Bacon himself had given up all hope of bringing his dream to fruition in his own country, and he concentrated his attention upon rooting it in the New World. He made sure that the American colonists were thoroughly indoctrinated with the principles of religious tolerance, political democracy, and social equality. Through carefully appointing representatives, the machinery of democracy was set up at least 100 years before the period of the Revolutionary War. Bacon's secret society membership was not limited to England. It was most powerful in Germany, in France, and in the Netherlands. and most of the leaders of European thought were involved in the vast pattern of his purpose. The mystic empire of the wise had no national boundaries, and its citizenry was made up of men of good purpose in every land. The alchemists, Kabbalists, mystics, and Rosicrucians were the incisive instruments of Bacon's plan. Representatives of these groups migrated to the colonies at an early date and set up their organization in suitable places. One example will indicate the trend. About 1690, the German pietist theologian Magister Johann Kelpius sailed for America with a group of followers, all of whom practiced mystical and esoteric rites. The pietists settled in Pennsylvania, and their descendants still flourish in Lancaster County. Kelpius, for some years, lived as an anchorite in a cave located in what is now Fairmont Park, Philadelphia. The pietists brought with them the writings of the German mystic Jacob Baum, books on magic, astrology, alchemy, and the Kabbalah. They had curious manuscripts illuminated with strange designs, and their principal text was called An ABC Book for Young Students Studying in the College of the Holy Ghost. The pietists brought the Order of the Mustard Seed and the Order of the Woman in the Wilderness to the New World. Kelpius was a man of feeble health, and after a few years died from the hardships and exposures of his religious austerity. The inner circle of his order was composed entirely of celibates, and as these died, there were none to take their places. And so far as the public knows, his secret society did not survive. Actually, it did continue, but with the changing of the times, it returned again to its secret foundations, disappearing entirely from the public view. The early years of the 18th century brought with them many changes in the social and political life of the American colonies. By this time, most of the Atlantic seaboard was dominated by the English. Cities had sprung up, important trade flourished with the mother country. The colonial atmosphere was in small counterpart that of the English countryside. By this time, most of the important secret societies of Europe were well represented in this country. The brotherhoods met in their rooms over inns and similar public buildings, practicing their ancient rituals exactly according to the fashion in Europe and England. These American organizations were branches under European sovereignty, with the members in the two hemispheres bound together with the strongest bonds of sympathy and understanding. The program that Bacon had outlined was working out according to schedule. Quietly and industriously, America was being conditioned for its destiny, leadership in the free world. Any account of secret societies in America would have to include tribute to the man who has been called the first American gentleman, Benjamin Franklin. Although Dr. Franklin was never the country's president, nor a military general, he stands out as one of the most important figures in the struggle for American independence. Quiet, dignified, scholarly, and gentle, Franklin foresaw a new goal for an ever-changing world through the square bifocal glasses of which he was the inventor. Historians never cease to wonder at the enormous psychological influence which Franklin exercised in colonial politics. But up to the present day, few indeed are those who have realized that the source of his power lay in the secret societies to which he belonged, and of which he was the appointed spokesman. Franklin was not a lawmaker, but his words became law. Beneath the homely wisdom which he circulated in his almanac, under the pseudonym of Poor Richard, was a profundity of scientific and philosophical learning. He understood both the farmer and the philosopher, and could speak the languages of both. When Benjamin Franklin went to France to be honored by the state, he was received, too, by the Lodge of Perfection, and the most famous of all the French secret orders, and his name, written in his own fine hand, is in their record ledger, close to that of the Marquis de Lafayette. Franklin spoke for the Order of the Quest, and most of the men who worked with him in the early days of the American Revolution were also members. The plan was working out. The new Atlantis was coming into being, in accordance with the program laid down by Francis Bacon 150 years earlier. The rise of American democracy was necessary to a world program. At the appointed hour, the freedom of man was publicly declared.
And we're listening to you boys and girls recite the Pledge of Allegiance all semester, and it seems as though it's becoming monotonous to you. If I may I recite it and try to explain to you the meaning of each word. I, me, an individual, a committee of one, pledge, dedicate all of my worldly goods to give without self-pity. Allegiance, my love and my devotion to the flag, our standard, O glory, a symbol of freedom. Wherever she waves, there's respect, because your loyalty has given her a dignity that shouts, freedom is everybody's job. United, that means that we have all come together. States, individual communities that have united into 48 great states, 48 individual communities with pride and dignity and purpose. All divided with imaginary boundaries, yet united to a common purpose, and that's love for country. And to the Republic, a state in which sovereign power is invested in representative chosen by the people to govern. And government is the people, and it's from the people to the leaders, not from the leaders to the people. For which it stands. One nation, meaning so blessed by God, indivisible, incapable of being divided, with liberty, which is freedom, the right of power to live one's own life without threats, fear, or some sort of retaliation, and justice, the principle or qualities of dealing fairly with others. For all. Which means, boys and girls, it's as much your country as it is mine. And now, boys and girls, let me hear you recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Welcome to Radio Freeman, coming to you, Austin, Texas.
Will you? Supposing I were to ask you, as a stranger going to the West to seek for that which was lost, what would you say then?
I should answer, where do you come from?
From the East, and I am hoping that you will give my message on the square for the sake of the widow's son.
Freemasons? Those chaps, I should think you'd strike them off your rolls.
Oh, once a Mason, always a Mason.
Never could understand how perfectly pucker chaps, like yourself, can go about on public occasions wearing aprons and sashes and shaking hands with total strangers. Just what is Masonry, Kipling?
Oh, it's an ancient order dedicated to the brotherhood of man under the all-seeing eye of God.
We should have done well to have left that sort of thing behind us in England, my friend. Could never work here.
Oh, there are tales that it did work here, before we ever came. Some audacious scholars can even trace it back to the builders of Solomon's Temple.
Old wives' tales, I suspect.
Yes, in all likelihood, sir.
Well, let's have a look at your large brothers.
Center of the lodge and and cause him to kneel for the benefit of prayer.
Who is this?
A poor candidate in a state of dark comes of his own free will, perfectly prepared, humbly soliciting to be admitted into the mysteries and privileges.
I, your name here, of my own free will and accord, in the presence of Almighty God and this worshipful lodge erected to him and dedicated to the holy saints John, do hereby and hereon most solemnly and sincerely promise and swear that I will always hail, ever conceal, and never reveal any of the secret arts, parts, or points of the fellowcraft degree to any person or persons whomsoever, except it be to a true and lawful brother fellowcraft, and within a regularly constituted lodge of fellowcrafts, neither unto him nor them until by strict trial, due examination, or legal information, I shall have found him or them as lawfully entitled to the same as I am myself. I furthermore solemnly promise and swear that I will stand to and abide by all the laws, rules, and regulations of the fellowcraft degree, so far as the same shall come to my knowledge. Furthermore, that I will answer and obey all due signs and summons sent to me from a lodge of fellowcrafts, or given to me by a brother of this degree, if within the length of my cable toe. Furthermore, that I will aid and assist all distressed worthy brother fellowcrafts, they applying to me as such, so far as their necessities may require and my ability permit, without material injury to myself. Furthermore, that I will not cheat, wrong, or defraud a lodge of fellowcrafts, nor a brother of this degree knowingly, nor supplant him in any of his laudable undertakings. To all of this I most solemnly and sincerely promise and swear, with a firm and steadfast resolution, to keep and perform the same, without any equivocation, mental reservation, or secret evasion of mind whatever, binding myself under no less a penalty than that of having my left breast torn open, my heart plucked out and given as prey to the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air, should I ever knowingly or willingly violate this my solemn oath and obligation as a fellowcraft mason. So help me God, and keep me steadfast in due performance of the same. Worshipful Master says, Brother, in token of your sincerity, and to make this obligation more binding, you will detach your hands and kiss the Holy Bible which lies open before you. Brother Senior Deacon, you will now release the brother from the cable toe, as he is bound to us by an obligation, a tie stronger than human hands can impose.
That's the day. cure for pain. That's the day I throw my drugs away. Will I find a cure? Will I find a cure for pain? Will I find a cure? Will I find a cure for pain?
Christopher Knight Robert Lomas in the Hiram Key wrote, "Most people in the Western world are at least vaguely aware of Freemasonry, and its mysteries tantalize two large groups, those who are not Freemasons, who wonder what the secrets of the order are, and those who are Masons, who also wonder what those secrets are. A compelling reason for silence amongst Masons is not so much a compulsion to adhere to their sacred vows, or a fear of a macabre retribution from their fellows. It is more that they do not understand a word of the ceremonies they participate in, and their only fear is that people would laugh at the apparently pointless and silly rituals they perform. Many ancient tribal peoples have had secret societies to help maintain the cultural values or reality tunnel of their tribe. Most men that join Freemasonry join in order to raise their status in civilization. It's well known amongst the military and the corporate world that if you are a widow's son, which is a code word for a Freemason, that you will be raised along the ladder more quickly. But what are these rituals about? These Freemasons go into this lodge and they put on their pajamas, is the best way to describe the clothing that they would wear. They have their left pant leg rolled up and their left breast bared, and they're blindfolded with a noose around their neck, what they call the cable toe, and they're led in to the lodge, hoodwinked, completely ignorant of what they're about to endure. They arrive upon the point of a dagger or sword and have to swear allegiance and swear a vow of secrecy of all that they will be shown here inside of this lodge. They then are taken around, circled around the altar, and put through the rites and rituals which reenact the life of Hiram Abiff in the building of Solomon's Temple. So what could it be that makes this moment in time so special that it would be continually reenacted over and over and over again? Imagine it's been done billions of times. Most lodges stick to the same ritual, and every candidate has to go through this. I was once at a protest in Washington, D.C. I had witnessed the events in Seattle when the people were protesting against the WTO and the IMF, that's the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund, and I had seen the violence that ensued against these protesters of the IMF and the WTO in Seattle, and decided, well, if they're going to do that, then they're going to do it to me. And I jumped in my van and headed out to Washington, D.C. for the next IMF WTO protest. And there I witnessed many things, and I will discuss much of the protesting that I've done in a later date. But there was a curious note because, 600 people got trapped in between a riot squad, just blocked off in this block of Washington, D.C., and there were another 700 of us on the other side of the riot squad that weren't trapped in between the two lines of this heavily armored police force. Interestingly, and a strange synchronicity, it turns out that my new roommate in Austin was one of those 600 people in Washington, D.C. years ago that was trapped there. My life never ceases to amaze me. Well, I stood there watching as these people were trapped, and they allowed the World Bank members to leave, and they allowed the press to leave out of the lines of police, and a few smart protesters that snuck out with the press. And I was yelling at all these riot cops, you know, this was where I did my first radio interview, now that I think about it. I was interviewed a couple of times standing there. I'm yelling at the police officers in their riot gear, you know, what about these people's rights, and how can you just do this? Can't you see that you're destroying our world, destroying America, and all that good stuff? And they paid me no attention whatsoever. They never looked in my direction. I continued to yell at them, and finally I thought I'd just test and see what would happen, and I yelled out to them, "How many of you are widow's sons?" And oh my God, they all looked in my direction. The lieutenants as well, the people in charge, everybody suddenly noticed me, and I ducked into the crowd and slowly crept away. I didn't want them to really know me at that point. Boy, that really made a spark. So, what is this widow's son, and why is it that so many of these police officers would be members of this organization, and why is it that they would react so to that statement and none to the fact that they're destroying America? Well, the truth is that this allegiance goes higher than your nationality. They try to say that it doesn't, but you look into it, you find that it does. Because they believe they are the reality manufacturers, and that we are the ones living in their world. So certainly Benjamin Franklin, of course, is a notable Freemason, and if you believe it, a Satanist. He was a member of the Hell's Fire Club in England, and there were 10 bodies that showed up under his house on the date, showing that they were there while he lived there. So, yeah, there's definitely more to this picture than a simple brotherhood of men getting together trying to do good works. So, when we look to Freemasonry, we find these people that are knowingly starting revolutions. This is something they're actually proud of, you know, that they started the French Revolution and they started the American Revolution. But if you realize that they're sworn not to kill one another, sworn not to hurt one another, then you start to be a little curious when you find out that 95% of the Masons, or 95% of the generals on both sides of the Revolutionary War were all Freemasons. You might start to understand why they would share brandy and cigars in the middle of warfield. There is a story in the Masonic Holy Bible. Now, recognize that this is just the King James Bible, but it's the Worshipful Master's Master Heritage Edition, the Master Reference. And within it, there is a number of questions and answers to Freemasons so that they can start to get an understanding of what they have joined. And really, like Knight and Lomas says, they really don't know what the origins of their order are, or what the point and purpose of the whole thing is. Most of them go through these rituals. My father was Worshipful Master, and he called the rituals gobbledygook. You know, he just things that they had to memorize. But within the questions and answers is the story of a Native American who was actually fighting for the British side. His name was Joseph Brant. He was a Mohawk Indian who was made a Mason in London in 1776. During the War of American Independence, he was in command of some Indian troops on the British side, by whom Captain McKinstry of the United States Army had been captured. The Indians had tied their prisoner to a tree and were preparing to torture him when he made the mysterious appeal of a Mason in the hour of danger. Now, this is to say that you would raise your hands above your head and say, O Lord, my God, will no one help this widow's son? And when he made the mysterious appeal of a Mason in the hour of danger, Brant interposed and rescued his American brother from his impending fate, took him to Quebec, and placed him in the hands of some English masons, who returned him uninjured to the American outposts. Okay, well, so I personally have visited many, many Masonic temples and asked questions such as these to try and get an idea of what these guys are about and what they think about. And I was at the temple in Lawrence, Acacia Lodge Number 1, which is a big Egyptian temple in downtown Lawrence, which nobody seems to notice. Lawrence, Kansas, that is. That's another curious thing about Freemasonry is that none of you notice. And I would be there in Lawrence, Kansas, and say, "Hey, you know that big Egyptian temple downtown, right? That's the Freemasons that I'm discussing." I mean, it does say Freemason Temple in big letters across the top of it, and have a big compass square and G all emblazoned in gold in the window. I mean, it stands out. There's, I mean, how many Egyptian temples do you think are downtown, right? And everybody in Lawrence, Kansas would say to me, "Oh, no, there's no temple downtown. You're crazy. I've lived here all my life." And then the next day, they'll be walking down the street and go, "Oh, my God, there is a big Egyptian temple down here in the middle of downtown. How did I miss it? How could I have not seen this?" Well, you know, nobody ever comes in or goes out of that building, so it just kind of sits there, and we lose complete sight of these type of things. It's very curious. So I went down to that temple because I like to see what the insides are like, and they happened to be having a luncheon, and they had invited the public to come and enjoy. So I did, and I brought a friend with me, and we went and we sat down. And it was interesting because they didn't let you carry your own food or anything. It was kind of a cafeteria or a buffet style, but they prepared your plate for you and prepared your tray, and then you went and sat down, and the ladies of the Eastern Star would bring you your plate. I chose a spot that put me close to some men that I knew would be brothers, and I started talking to them, and you know, of course, I revealed the fact that my father was worshipful master of the Kaiserslautern Lodge in Germany, and they were like, "Oh," and they started to open up to me, and they started to tell me tales of how when they joined the military, they weren't yet members of the Freemasons or Widow's Sons, and soon found that it was definitely to their benefit to do so and would join. And then, after they had joined, they were telling me stories. Well, one particular story was told to me that this man was supposedly going to be sent to a particular base or a mission that was suddenly changed for him, and he was shipped off somewhere else, and all of the men that weren't Freemasons were shipped off there and turned up dead. The base was taken out. And he's like, "Yeah, you see?" And then they started to tell me about the Russian Freemasons and how the military there had sent many men to Siberia to die. And if you had a Freemason ring, you were excluded from the dying. And they continued to tell me stories like this of how you don't die when you're a Freemason. And they were like, "Don't you think that this is good? Wouldn't you like to join?" No, this kind of goes against everything I consider good. I don't think that select people that have sworn an oath and allegiance to this brotherhood should be allowed to live, where those that have not should be allowed to die, because obviously somebody knows who's living or dying in this point, because they gave me story after story. It was during the WTO protest that I had discovered the House of the Temple, or the Supreme Mother Council of the World, which is known as the Temple of the 33rd. It was kind of a shock to stumble upon this. You know, we were just walking in a neighborhood, and all of a sudden there's this big temple with sphinxes out in front of it, and very curious placement for it. And it turns out it's actually in due alignment with the Washington Monument. But I went inside there, and I started talking with the lead historian, who was a lady there, and she took me on the tour, and once they had found out who my father was, they then started to release a little more information, and she gave me copies of Morals and Dogma, which is a book by Albert Pike, one of the lead Freemasons, and well, very curious man. And you know, she tells me, well, this place is haunted, you know, and I was really not surprised, and I told her so. And you know, the rituals that these Freemasons do, which they don't understand, and Albert Pike expounds within Morals and Dogma, state that clearly this is a Kabbalism, that this is a form of ritual magic that these people are performing. And I will get deeper into that hopefully in the next hour, next week, because you know, it takes a lot to explain all of this, for sure. So here they are, these brothers practicing a ritual magic that they don't understand, and, you know, my father, who ran the rituals, calls it gobbledygook, and yet they continue on, and there has been some curious notes as to where these rituals might come from, because this character, the widow's son, Hiram Abiff, is supposedly the builder of Solomon's temple, is not in the Bible, in the story of the building of Solomon's temple, and even the Freemasons say that he is allegorical, and that this is not a true story, that it's more to teach you morals. But of course, once they're done with the ritual, they can't figure out what morals that this was to teach. And as I started to look, and I found the works of Zechariah Sitchin and the ideas of the Nephilim, I found it very curious that Zechariah Sitchin also noted that King Hiram of Tyre was one of the people to be taken off of this planet by the gods, much like Enoch and, I believe, Elijah. Well, King Hiram of Tyre is the grand king that brought Hiram Abiff to build Solomon's temple to house the Ark of the Covenant. Zechariah Sitchin in his Earth Chronicles states that King Hiram of Tyre was taken off the planet. And now all of a sudden we've got this character that comes along with him, Hiram Abiff, and he is reported by the Freemasons to be the first Master Mason, and he was supposed to give the secrets of the Master Mason to the workers of Solomon's temple. Now, it's curious that the story goes that Hiram Abiff and two others held this secret knowledge, and they were the only three on the planet that had this secret knowledge, and yet Hiram claims that he was going to give these secrets to the Masons of the building of Solomon's temple when they completed the work. Could this Hiram Abiff have been an extraterrestrial, a Nephilim that was brought back with King Hiram of Tyre when he was taken off the planet with the gods? It's just a curious note, really, but when you start to look into this picture, you really got to start to think this way. Is really what we're looking at is building that is beyond our understanding. You know, the buildings go on through the pyramids and through the temples of, say, Luxor and Karnak that are just amazing, or Abu Simbel, or we get to move forward through time up to the Gothic cathedrals and the buildings by the Templars, and these things defy gravity, you know, and we can move forward into today with the Coral Castle, and that is defying our understanding of gravity there. So this has always been high technology used for this order. So what is it doing? Can we admit that someone with superior technology was meddling around in human affairs in the ancient past? Well, Bruce Rooks, another Freemason who wrote the book Architects of the Underworld, states that neither science nor religion are demoted by the incorporation of extraterrestrial intervention theory, but are actually made more sensible by it. There is evidence of science and technology in the Ark of the Covenant. Its science could well answer a few questions, such as how great weights were lifted by the ancients in the construction of their megaliths. John Anthony West suggested that sound may have been used for that purpose, based on two pieces of evidence. One is that we are today capable of lifting minuscule objects of negligible weight by the employment of sound technology, holding them in pockets created by reflection of sound waves between two amplifying discs. The other is that Egyptian artifacts, especially the gigantic obelisks, are demonstrably harmonic, meaning that they resonate on an audible frequency when struck. Partially supporting West's idea is mythology itself. Merlin was said to have danced the stones of Stonehenge into place by his magic, and that magic, the magic of the fairy folk, was music. Apollo similarly employed music in building, as recorded in H. A. Gerber's The Myth of Greece and Rome. Apollo went to assist Neptune, who had also been banished to Earth, to build the walls of Troy. Scorning to perform any menial tasks, the god of music seated himself nearby and played such inspiring tunes that the stones moved into place of their own accord. West did not mention, as other authors have, that the so-called king's coffer in the Great Pyramid also is harmonic. That coffer has the exact same dimensions as the Ark of the Covenant. When given a sharp slap with the hand, the coffer can be heard to give off a low note that lasts a considerable amount of time. And this theory also explains what the mysterious dead spaces are above the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid, called by some relieving spaces, which may actually be one of their functions is to be an earthquake buffer, there being no reason why they must present only one single reason, and called spirit stones by the Egyptians. There is no reason they could not also be resonance chambers, as Zechariah Sitchin has suggested, each successive one resonating the sound for greater amplification. We would do well to recall the substantial evidence for the moons of both Earth and Mars being hollow, on our moon known also to resonate. Sound resonation could have applications in physics for the movement of tremendous masses that we are now only beginning to suspect. Indeed, the brilliant inventor Nikola Tesla considered exactly such a thing. The question of extraterrestrial contact in antiquity is essentially one of context. If one assumes, from the outset, that the study of ancient civilization is that of agrarian societies in stages of evolutionary progression, then that becomes the filter through which discovered facts are established, and anything contrary to that idea will be ignored, dismissed, or forgotten as an anomalous misperception. That same filter is the reason why the eyes of trained geologists miss the water damage to the Sphinx. This presumption of evolving civilization has ruled all scholarly and scientific inquiry from the beginning, for the quite understandable reason that, without any evidence to the contrary, it would seem likelier that man is an isolated creature on a planet fortunate enough to have evolved him. Though evidence has emerged for the alternate argument of extraterrestrial intervention and or colonization in antiquity, counter-research has been slowed by the tremendous opposition it faces from the scientific and academic communities. In actuality, some serious research into the question of extraterrestrial intervention was done at least 15 years before the Viking Martian discoveries of pyramids on Mars, and other structures as well. Many scientists, unashamed to go on the record with their belief that ancient astronauts were involved in man's early development, Carl Sagan, as Shalotsky's translator, even brought up the ancient divinity Oans in regard to the theory. Oans is the most ancient legendary creature or race credited with the founding of human civilization on Earth, according to the Babylonian historian priest Berosus, with roots going all the way back to the beginning of Sumer as the god Enki. Certain tribes of Africa refer to him as Nomo, and to his race as the race of Nomos. One of these tribes, the Dogon, alternately call this race the masters of water, the instructors, and the monitors. His race is sometimes referred to in Babylonian writings as the Anunnaki, for which no proper translation is available, but which Robert K. G. Temple believes is a form of Anunnaki, or repulsive one. It may instead be a derivation of the Sumerian Anunnaki, meaning they who from heaven to earth came, in probable closest translation. The American Indian Anasazi, to which the Hopi tribe belongs, sounds much like the latter, with a similar meaning to the Sumerian term, the Ancient Ones. A form of Oans deteriorated into an agricultural deity with few of his former attributes is better known to Western society as the Bible's Philistine god Dagon, who is the Oticon of the historian Apollodorus. Representations of him have been found on Assyrian cylinder seals, and at least part of one giant statue of him was found sometime around 1853. These were the merfolk. If you recognize that much of the story does go back to the mythology or perhaps history of Atlantis, and if you know that Atlantis is famous for merfolk, or the mermaids, the merman, then you start to understand this Oans Enki picture a little. Well, maybe not understand, but recognize that it does have fish people origins, and we start to become very curious about that, because everything I have studied about the Freemasons constantly brings me back to the merfolk. And it's curious that the word mer in Egypt means the pyramid. It is the word for pyramid. So as we continue to look to the Freemasons, we come back to this concept of the fish people, the merfolk, Oans, Enki, Dagon. And the connection between the fish people and Sirius, the dog star. Now, as we get to the Freemason symbolism, then we realize that this five-pointed star that we see all over the place, actually to the Freemasons, is a symbol of Sirius. And Sirius is reputedly where the fish people come from, according to a study by Robert Temple in his book The Sirius Mystery. And I have shown you in my film, Columbia, of the arrival of what seems to be these beings from Sirius in transdimensional craft, arriving over Mali, Africa, where the Dogon tribe stay. Very curious. So when we look to the symbolism of our world and we're wondering where our allegiance lies, then we can recognize that the symbol or the hieroglyph that the Egyptians use for Sirius is an obelisk, a dome, and a pentagram. Now, I personally here in Austin can step right out and go look and find that there is an obelisk, a dome, and a pentagram as our state capital. And certainly at Washington, D.C., and also in Denver and numerous other places, including Vatican City, right, where they have the obelisk dome. I'm certain you can find a pentagram. This is the hieroglyph, the Egyptian hieroglyph for Sirius. So we have to start to question these extraterrestrial roots of our civilization here on planet Earth. So when Bill Clinton states,
When at long last the Constitution finally was signed, Mr. Franklin said, "I have often wondered whether that sun was rising or setting. Today I have the happiness to know it is a rising sun."
And it's obvious that the people have no idea what he's referring to. It is actually Sirius, the sun behind the sun, that he is referring to, and this is where the allegiance of this Freemasonic and secret society order does lie. Okay, so next week we will get into the signs and symbols of the Freemasons, and you can follow along on freemantv.com. And if you want to catch up on any of these radio shows or my TV shows, please visit freemanarchives.com. And if you want to help and help support the show and my works, you can send any donations or letters of encouragement to Freeman at P.O. Box 4051, Austin, Texas, 78765. I truly love doing this with you folks. I'm going to keep doing it as long as I can. And this time goes by so fast. It's amazing. So until next week, enjoy your time here on Earth.
All the little life forms upon this little earth multiplying, dying, and returning to rebirth. All the little children growing up in space, adding their small stories to the history of this race. Here on Earth, here on Earth, here on Earth, here on Earth. Time is searching for the way the world was made. Money spinning, streaming all the gifts from the arcade. All the wine I'm drinking to a methylated god. All the sleeping prisoner who got by the book of blood. Here on Earth, here on Earth, here on Earth, here on Earth, here on Earth.
Heaven sent.